Mountain Hill Radio contains graphic language and scenes some listeners may find troubling. Listener discretion is advised. To hear is absolutely fictional. The town of Mountain Hill is just that, a town. The people of Mountain Hill are just people, and never has there been a true case of a monster stealing a human's skin. The forests do not contain fairy creatures from another world, the streets are not terrorized by monsters who only come out at night, and the water is perfectly safe to swim in. You're safe here, we promise. This is Mountain Hill Radio. Unconscious for 2 days following their confrontation with the beast, his body slowly mending as Lyra, Colin, and Dorothy watch. They each take turns sitting with him, talking his ear off despite the fact that he's sleeping, just to make sure that when he wakes up, he's not alone. Finally, on the third day, Rufus's eyes flutter open. He's greeted by Dorothy, who sits in a chair beside his bed, twirling a knife in her fingers. Her bright blue gaze finds his immediately, and the smile on her face makes him feel odd. "You're awake," she says brightly, leaning forward to feel his forehead. "Your fever's gone, too. How you feeling?" Rufus contemplates for a moment.
"Shitty. What happened?"
Dorothy chuckles, though he can't help but notice the worry lines bracketing her eyes. "Well, you and Colin came toe-to-toe with the beast, and he knocked you on your ass. Colin tried to heal you, but his magic just ended up making you sick. Lyra and I found y'all a moment too late." She shakes her head. "I'm sorry you were hurt, Rufus." He reaches out and squeezes her hand gently.
"It's not your fault."
She nods, though he can tell she doesn't believe him. "Lyra and I carried you back to your house, and Mrs. Bell came to patch you up. You've been asleep for a couple days." Rufus frowns.
"A couple days? Because of my injury?"
She shakes her head. "No, you've been sick. When Colin tried to heal you, it gave you a fever and a cough and the sniffles." She smiles reassuringly, though he can tell by her tone and the way she keeps looking him over that it was more than that. "We aren't totally sure why that happened, since Colin has apparently healed you before, but..." "Rufus!" Mrs. Bell appears suddenly in the doorway, her brown eyes sparkling with unshed tears. "Oh, darling, you're awake!" Rufus is swarmed by an emotional Mrs. Bell, who Dorothy explains has been basically living with them the past few days. Lyra, Colin, Renford, and Tilly all show up within an hour, Tilly having brought her homemade chicken noodle soup. He will never admit this to either woman, but he sort of likes Tilly's recipe a little better. Renford leaves a stack of paperback novels on the nightstand and makes Rufus promise to read them all while he's still on bed rest. Lyra hugs him, but Colin stays back, looking unsure of himself. When all the commotion dies down, they begin to discuss what happened the other night. "So, Colin already told us what he saw, but I want to know your half of the story. Did the beast do or say anything to you that Colin might have missed?" Mrs. Bell asks. Rufus thinks for a moment, then shakes his head.
"The only thing I remember is talking to him, telling him he couldn't take Colin, and in the blink of an eye, he was standing in front of me. He dug his claws into my chest, and it felt like..."
Rufus shudders, reliving the sensation once more as he tells the story.
"It felt like he lit my bones on fire."
Everyone looks a little queasy. Mrs. Bell says, "We don't know what he did to you, but it's clear he must have done something. Because less than a week ago, Colin was able to heal you without any issue.
The moment the beast dropped you on the ground, it seems Colin's magic had no effect on you except to make you extremely ill. Rufus mulls over that. Do you think it's possible that he, I don't know, cursed me somehow? It's silent as everyone thinks this over. Finally, Mrs. Bell says, it's entirely possible, Rufus. She rubs at her brow, pinching the bridge of her nose as if she has a headache. This reminds me of when you were sick as a child. Rufus frowns. How so? She shrugs. Your parents always thought I was a little odd, but when you first fell ill, they brought me over to your house and asked me to look at you. I don't know if you remember this, but I used to work as a nurse at the town clinic until that other clinic opened up about an hour away from here. When they brought me to you, I remember thinking you had the flu. Turned out that wasn't the case. She shakes her head. I don't know, but seeing your symptoms this time around, they were very similar to an extreme case of the flu. How old were you when you got sick? Dorothy asks suddenly. Rufus frowns, not entirely sure why that matters. 11? Didn't your cousin go missing around that time? She asks. A memory sparks then of Rufus trying to connect the dots between his cousin's disappearance, his sickness, and Sammy's disappearance. He did. Mrs. Bell's eyes widen. You're right. He went missing about a month after you got sick. It was part of why your family decided to move out of town. But how is that connected to what's happening now? Lyra asks. Rufus sees the gleam in her eyes that says she's working through a problem in her head. Were you close to your cousin? Rufus nods. Inseparable. The room falls quiet again, and finally Colin says, They curse you to keep you out of their way. It's the first time he's spoken up since he and Lyra first arrived, and Rufus wants to ask about that. He knows he won't get very far in a room full of people, though, so instead he just says, Why curse me? Why not just kill me? Lyra's eyes widen, and she turns to Tilly. Your father knew about the creatures. How likely is it that he kept records of how many folks were killed by them? Tilly frowns. I mean, it's likely, but I don't really remember him ever mentioning anything of the sort. But realistically, outside of people going missing, how many people have been found dead at the hands of the creatures? Room goes silent again. Dorothy clears her throat. Andy? Lyra's eyes soften. I'm sorry. Dorothy shakes her head. Don't worry about it. Wait, Rufus says, turning to Dorothy. This is the worst thing that has ever come out of my mouth, and I apologize in advance for that, but was there a body? Dorothy's face pales, though she smiles slightly, trying to hide her pain. She says, Lots of blood. Enough for a body, I expect. Lyra snaps her fingers. He is right, though. We found no evidence, save for the blood, that your cousin was even there. What if... She shakes her head, trailing off. I don't know what we would do about it, even if we knew this theory might be correct. She takes a deep, shuddering breath. Tilly, I want to get a look at your father's files. You should look with me, see if he left any hints as to whether he suspected a creature was involved in any disappearances. Colin, I want you to stay here and keep an eye on Rufus. Rufus opens his mouth to object, and she lifts a hand, stopping him in his tracks. Until we know just exactly what is going on with you, you are staying put. As of right now, Dorothy and I will handle all patrols until further notice. This time, Colin steps forward. You guys can't do that. We can, and we will. You need to stay here, and unfortunately, you need to run some tests. Find out what Rufus is weak to and what doesn't affect him. You're the only one of us who can, and I am not risking his life for the sake of experimenting with the creatures. Do some research, take some notes, and try to figure out what's going on. Colin sighs, but nods anyways. Rufus wants to argue that he's fine, but his body is exhausted, and even just speaking to his friends is taking a toll on him. He knows he would only slow them down if he came out to patrol tonight, and besides, she's right. Okay, he says, nodding and sitting back against his headboard. Just be safe, please. Lyra's eyes soften and she nods. We will. Dorothy, as if detecting Rufus's exhaustion, says, All right, everybody out. We got work to do. Colin? He looks at her. You protect our boy, all right? Colin swallows thickly and nods.
Dorothy tosses a wink Rufus's way, and he wonders just how she realized he wanted to talk to Colin alone. Everyone shuffles out, telling Rufus to get well soon before Dorothy shuts the bedroom door behind her, leaving him alone with Colin. Colin sits in the chair Dorothy previously occupied, doing his best not to fidget under Rufus's stare. They've been sitting like this, in dead silence, for several minutes, and he knows the questions are coming. He just wishes Rufus would get it over with already. Finally, after it seems an eternity has passed, Rufus says, "Why are you being weird?" Colin grimaces. "I'm not." Rufus holds up a hand. "Don't say you're not being weird. You're being weird." His eyes narrow a fraction, then widen with understanding that makes Colin's heart race. "Wait. You don't blame yourself for all this, do you?" Colin swallows past the knot in his throat. He knows he wears his feelings plainly on his face, remembers Troy telling him as much often when they were younger and, well, still talking, but he can't help it. Colin doesn't know how to not express his feelings, doesn't know how to keep them bottled inside so no one ever knows he isn't just perfectly happy and content all the time. "Colin," Rufus says, shaking his head, "it wasn't your fault. I will always gladly step in front of my friends to protect them. Always. And if I hadn't stepped in front of you, the beast would have taken you, and you wouldn't have given Sammy back. I doubt they would have given Sammy back even if you'd gone willingly. There was no other way for that situation to have gone." I know that," Colin says. "I do. It's just hard not to feel like it's my fault that you got hurt." "I'm okay, Colin, and I don't blame you in the least. You were not the one who shoved their claws deep in my chest, nor were you the one to evidently curse me. Whatever the hell that means." Rufus sighs and leans his head back against his headboard, closing his eyes. "Can you believe just a few weeks ago our lives were normal?" Colin laughs despite himself. "Normal, but lonely." "True," Rufus says. "I need you to forgive yourself, Colin. Forgive what you believe you did wrong, so you can move past this. No one blames you for the other night, least of all me. You're my friend. Our friend." Colin feels his throat tighten and he says, "Okay, I can try to do that." "Good." "So," Colin says, "Lyra thinks I should try using some magic near you and see how it affects you. Are you feeling well enough for that now, or should we wait a bit before doing tests?" He cringes at the word. "I don't like the idea of experimenting on you." Rufus chuckles. "Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the idea of being experimented on, but this is the safest way to do it, I think. At least it'll help us figure out, I don't know, what I'm weak against?" He shakes his head. "This is wild, man." "I couldn't agree more," Colin says. "Alright, I'm not going to do anything directly to you. I already tried healing you on multiple occasions over the last few days, but each time you just got more and more sick. So, obviously, that's a no-go." He lifts a hand, feeling his magic awaken inside him, buzzing under his skin. "You ready?" Rufus nods, and Colin lets a small amount of his magic free, just enough to create a small wall of flame in the palm of his hand. He marvels at the level of control he has, the amount of willpower he has mastered over the past several weeks since discovering he has magic. Instantly, sweat breaks out across Rufus's brow, and he shifts away from the ball of flame. Colin shuts off the flow of his power immediately, and Rufus relaxes a little as the ball of flame dissipates. "Did that hurt you?" Colin asks. Rufus shakes his head. "No, it was just hot," he sighs. "I think it made me feverish." Colin nods, taking note of the sudden flush to Rufus's skin and the sweat beating across his brow. "Okay, I think that's all I want to do for today. There's no reason to push you." Rufus shakes his head. "I'm sorry." Colin snorts. "Why are you apologizing?" "I don't know. I just wish there were an easier way to figure this out. Someone we could ask that could give us a straight answer." Rufus shrugs. "It is what it is, I guess." Colin searches for something to say, something to reassure him, but the thing is, Rufus is right. They're totally in the dark, working off of theories and gut feelings. "I hope Lyra and Dorothy learn something," he says, leaning back in his chair. "Me too," Rufus says. "Do you want to play video games or something?" Colin quirks a brow at him. "Video games?" Rufus smirks. "Hell yeah." "Okay," Colin shrugs, rising from his chair and offering Rufus a hand up. Video games it is. Lyra offers to walk Dorothy to the diner, wanting some one-on-one time with her that doesn't involve patrolling the town. They're silent for a while, both feeling relieved that Rufus is awake and talking and doing better than he has been doing for the past several days. Lyra knows the three of them blame themselves for what happened the other night, knows nothing she says to either Colin or Dorothy will stop them from feeling that guilt eat away at them, knows there's nothing she can tell herself to stop the guilt eating away at her own soul. It was her idea, after all, to split the team up. Though she knows the plan she had was solid enough, she wishes she would have had more foresight to prevent Rufus getting hurt. Possibly cursed. She wants to laugh a little at that, at the fact that her life has changed so radically in such a short period of time that becoming cursed is normal. But she wouldn't trade any of this for the world, wouldn't give up the friends she made without a fight. Which is exactly why she and Dorothy are going to fight tonight. I want to track down the beast, Lyra says finally. And I want to kill it. I like where your head's at, but what if it's like the Merc? Dorothy frowns. What if we can't kill it? Then we fight until we can't anymore. I know that's grim, but... No, Dorothy says. I know I've only known y'all for a short while, but I've come to think of every single one of you as friends. I would do anything for my friends. Have done anything for my friends before. If it means tracking down a horrible monster and trying to kill it in order to get some answers, then that's what I'll do. Lyra smiles. I'm glad you're on board. We can't tell little boys, though. Oh, absolutely not. They'll just try to talk us out of it. Dorothy grips her umbrella tighter, and Lyra almost wishes she would have bought one for herself. The rain has not let up at all in the last few days. In fact, it's only gotten worse. Tilly has been spending her time helping bring supplies to folks around town and preparing for the very real possibility of heavy flooding in the area. They've been lucky so far that only the land nearest the river has been flooded, but if the rain continues on like this, it's only a matter of time until the town gets hit. Let's meet at Lost Fiction at 6, Lyra says. I want to get a head start. I have a feeling we're in for a long night. Dorothy agrees, and finally, Lyra leaves her at the diner. She and Tilly arrange to meet in half an hour, but as she makes her way towards the sheriff's station for their meeting, she senses something off about the street around her. Lyra stops, glancing around the empty street, trying to see if anything is amiss. When she finds nothing, she shrugs, ready to keep walking. Lyra! The voice, eerie and haunting, scrapes across her mind. Her heart leaps into her throat, and she glances around again, trying to find the source. The telltale glowing that accompanied the voice last time isn't there, but as her eyes land upon the building she stands in front of, the voice says, "There." She frowns, but knows better than to question the guidance this voice is offering. If the weird glowing ethereal being wants her to go into Melody's Curiosities and Antiques, then she's going in. The store is in a small, unassuming brick building. There are two windows on either side of the front door, both covered in bars Lyra assumes are made of iron. There is a sign on the front door that is flipped to the side that says, "Come on in, we're open." Lyra glances up and down the street once more, before climbing the three steps of the door and pulling it open. Inside, she is greeted by a myriad of smells, ranging from incense to candles to a spice of some kind. Her eyes don't immediately know what to focus on first. They bounce from the display on her left of different knives and daggers, to the wall overflowing with artworks of all different types. Paintings, sketches, digital art prints, colored pencil drawings. To her right is a spinning rack that contains jewelry made from all sorts of different things. Feathers, beads, crystals, silver, and gold. The back of the store is divided into two sections. One half is full of furniture that looks as though it belongs in a different century. The other half is full of clothing that looks displaced by time as well. The store is an eclectic mix of old and new, strange and ordinary, and Lyra wonders why exactly it took her this long to actually enter the store in the first place. But she recalls hardly ever glancing towards it in the months she's lived here, never really noticing it until it's been decided by fate or whatever other forces that it's time for her to see it. There's something in the store she needs, whether she truly wants it or not. "Oh!" a woman calls from somewhere in the back. She appears suddenly from around a tall grandfather clock, and Lyra's brows raise at the unfamiliar woman. It isn't often, in a small town like this, that you meet someone new who isn't a tourist. She rushes from the back of the store, passing the counter in the center of the room that holds a cash register, as well as a glass jewelry display case. She sticks her hand out to Lyra, saying, "Hello, dear, I'm Melody." Lyra shakes her hands, smiling softly at the woman. Nice to meet you. I'm Lyra. Melody nods, waving her hand around her head. She has long black hair, wavy and thick. Her skin is a dark tan shade, and her eyes are golden brown. She's wearing a knee-length mustard-colored summer dress with red polka dots and spaghetti straps that reveal a large bird tattooed across her collarbone and shoulder, with its wings stretching down her left arm until it reaches her elbow. It's good to meet you. Bells have told me to keep an eye out for you, said you'd probably find your way here eventually. She smiles, and she has dimples in both cheeks. I'm glad you made it in today. What can I help you with? Looking for anything in particular? Lyra shakes her head. I'm not sure. I just felt drawn in here, I guess. Melody nods. Every patron who comes to my shop says as much, but every patron who enters always leaves with everything they were meant to have. Lyra contemplates that for a moment, looking Melody up and down. She wonders if perhaps Melody knows more about the circumstances in town than she should, but decides she's not going to ask. Instead, she says, Mind if I glance around for a bit? I have a meeting with Sheriff Thornton in a little less than half an hour, so I won't be in long. Melody smiles. Of course. You're always welcome in, Lyra. You and your three friends. Lyra nods her thanks, not really sure what to say, and Melody heads behind the counter. She picks up a book, a very well-loved copy of Bram Stoker's Dracula, and sits on a stool. She begins reading, immediately completely engrossed by the novel, seeming to have already forgotten about Lyra's presence. This way. Now the voice is like a whisper in her ear, causing the hair on the back of her neck to stand on end and goosebumps to rise on her arms. She takes a deep breath, tucking her hands into her pockets to hide their trembling. It feels as though a rope is wrapped around her abdomen, and someone is gently tugging her towards the wall on her left. She looks it over as she approaches it, looking at all sorts of clocks, hanging sculptures, hand-embroidered art, and more paintings. She feels the imaginary rope pull tighter, tugging her farther along the wall, and she moves slowly, eyes tracking every single hanging thing before her, trying to find out what it is the voice has sent her to find. And then, it's there. She stares at the item in disbelief, a mix of fascination and perplexion as she tries to understand why it is this item, out of everything in this store, she was meant to find. With a shaking hand, Lyra traces the rusted metal object. It has a long cylindrical piece that she guesses must be a handle of some kind. On one end is the vague, abstract shape of a dragon in flight, its wings spread out on either side, ending in four sharp points, two on either side of the handle. The centerpiece is triangular, ending in a sharp point that has a gap in the middle, almost as if this item was meant to fit onto something. On the other end of the handle, Lyra sees a green crystal of some kind, shaped perfectly like a diamond on a deck of cards. She stares at it a long time, trying to understand what it is she's looking at when, finally, it's a sword hilt, she breathes, tracing shapes embossed on the middle wings that almost look like characters in a foreign alphabet. She reaches up and wraps her hand around the grip, finding it to be comfortable and wrapped in some sort of leathery material that, despite the rest of the hilt's rusted appearance, doesn't look worn in the least. She lifts it carefully from the wall, flipping it so it now appears as though the abstract dragon is flying downwards. Is that what you were meant to find? Melody asks, and Lyra nearly jumps out of her skin at the woman's sudden proximity. She turns to face her, and Melody's eyes land on the hilt, but quickly dance away, as if she can't bear to look at it. I think so, Lyra says, and Melody smiles warmly. Then let's get that wrapped up for you. 20 minutes later, Lyra's backpack, which she has taken to carrying to have a quick access to a first aid kit, her water bottle, and snacks, is heavy with the weight of the sword hilt she purchased in Melody's shop, and she is standing in the lobby of the sheriff's station. Tilly's in her office, reading through case files, when Lyra lightly knocks on the door. Without looking up, Tilly waves her in, telling her to shut the door behind her. Lyra sits in one of the chairs in front of Tilly's desk, setting her backpack on the floor in front of her. Tilly's office is sparse, but Lyra notes the small impact she and her friends have made on the space. A small drawing of Tilly's favorite flower, peonies, drawn by Colin, stuck on the corkboard behind her desk with a push pin. A small cat statue Lyra had in her things when she moved here that she gifted Tilly. a poster featuring various Appalachian wildlife that Rufus found hanging in his warehouse that Tilly claimed for herself. There isn't anything from Dorothy yet, but the woman hasn't been in town long enough for Tilly to warm up to her. They sit in silence for a few minutes, and Lyra taps lightly on her knee, patiently waiting for Tilly to finish what she was doing before she arrived. She always enjoys spending time with Tilly, away from everyone else, because while the sheriff has a gruff exterior, she is an absolute softie in reality. Her entire personality shifts slightly when she's spending time with you one-on-one, and Lyra likes the way she feels soothed in her presence. She just likes spending time with Tilly, and that's that. Finally, Tilly looks up from the file she's reading and says, "You were right." Lyra raises a brow. "About? Dad was keeping track of things he believed had to do with the creatures. Look at this." Tilly hands over the file and taps on a symbol scribbled on the corner of the page. It's small, something that would go unnoticed by anyone who wouldn't know to look for it. Just a simple letter X. "I'm not sure if it really means anything," Tilly says, setting the file down on the desk. "In fact, I'm certain it was just Dad's way of keeping track of things, but still, I don't think I would have even noticed it if I wasn't looking for something out of the ordinary. I started pulling files for all the deaths and disappearances in Mountain Hill during the time my father was sheriff. When I started going through them, I realized many of the files were marked with an X in the top left-hand corner of the first page." "How many of those were deaths and how many were disappearances?" Lyra asks. "That's the thing. Not a single death has that symbol marked on it. As far as I can tell by looking at files from even before my father's time, reaching back to my grandfather and great-grandfather, this is the case. All of them marked the files in some small way, but only the ones where the person disappeared." She shakes her head. "It's mind-boggling, to say the least. Everything we know about these creatures point to them being violent and bloodthirsty. Hell, every single one you fought to this point has tried to kill you, but somehow they've never killed an innocent civilian." Lyra finds that, even though she was the one to suggest the theory in the first place, she can't exactly wrap her head around it either. "Do you think somehow it's different for us? That maybe the creatures don't care about the people who know nothing about them. They just care about the things who they can fight. Like a show of dominance or some bullshit like that?" Tilly chews on her bottom lip, contemplating. "I wouldn't rule it out at this point. I mean, my dad was killed by a creature. Renford and Mrs. Bell witnessed it with their own eyes. So clearly, it's entirely possible that you're not too far from the truth. It raises an interesting theory, though." "And what is that?" Tilly's eyes are shadowed when they meet Lyra's, and Lyra feels her heart drop just a little when she says, "That the creatures aren't coming here accidentally at all. They're being sent here. And if someone is sending them here, it might mean they are either trying to get a scope of the land in the area, or..." Lyra swallows past the sudden lump forming in her throat. "Or they're being sent to destroy the opposition. To kill us, so when whoever is doing this crosses over, there will be no one left to fight them." It's Raven, host and story writer of Mountain Hill Radio, here with some quick announcements. I don't have a whole lot to talk about this episode, so this will be brief. First, I wanted to mention that there's now a Facebook group for fans of Mountain Hill Radio. It's called Mountain Hill Radio Discussion Group, and it's the perfect place to talk about new episodes as they're released and to connect with other folks who are fans of the show. Come join the group, hang out, and make new friends. Second, I wanted to remind you to follow the podcast on social media if you haven't yet. You can find the show at Mountain Hill Radio Podcast on Instagram, Mountain Hill Radio Pod on TikTok, Mountain Hill Radio on Twitter, and Mountain Hill Radio Podcast on Facebook. Make sure to follow the show so you don't miss out whenever there are important announcements and updates about the show. Third, I wanted to remind everybody that you can now rate your favorite podcast on Spotify. This feature helps the show be recommended to other folks who might enjoy it, so be sure to leave a rating. The same goes for Apple Podcasts. Rate and review the show in order to help spread the word about it. Speaking of spreading the word, if you post about the show, make sure to use the hashtag Mountain Hill Radio so I can see it. Finally, all music featured in the show was written and produced by Zach Bradshaw. You can find more of his tunes at Nautilus of the Tide on all streaming platforms. That wraps up everything I had to say about Mountain Hill Radio for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a safe and pleasant week ahead of you. Dorothy stops by the house she shares with Rufus on her way to Lost Fiction. She grabs her set of knives she brought with her to town and picks up the crossbow she bought recently. She hasn't been able to use it in Mountain Hill yet, doesn't even really know if she'll be able to, but decides it can't hurt to carry the thing with her. She tucks it and the knives into her backpack and pulls it on, feeling a mix of dread and excitement as she makes her way to Rufus's room. She cracks the door open and peers inside, half expecting to find Rufus asleep in his bed and Colin reading through journals in the chair she left him in. What she doesn't expect, though, is the sight of Colin and Rufus holding controllers, both furiously pressing buttons as they hyperfocus on the TV mounted on the wall across the room. They're playing some video game or another, and are so totally invested that neither of them notice she's there. She smiles to herself, pulling the door shut before she slips silently from the house. When she left earlier, there had certainly been a weird vibe between Rufus and Colin, but now it seems they figured their shit out and are getting along nicely. Dorothy knew it would only be a matter of leaving them alone for a while for them to get past it, but still, she's happy to see that they're good. The walk to Lost Fiction is spent fighting against the wind trying to destroy her umbrella. She loses the fight before she even makes it to the bookstore, scowling at the umbrella she just bought as she folds its broken arms back up. She's wearing her hat, a small black cowboy hat she bought so long ago she can't remember where she got it from. Andy used to tease her about the thing, but Dorothy loves it. Plus, it goes well with the cowboy boots she wears, and she decided to stop caring a long time ago what other people think of her. She's not sure how her hat stays in place when her umbrella couldn't even survive the storm, but she's not going to start questioning her luck, or lack thereof, now. Lyra's waiting for her, leaning against the side of the building when Dorothy finally makes it to the store. She raises a brow at the broken umbrella, but silently unlocks the door to let Dorothy in to set the damn thing down. Lyra is wearing her backpack as well and asks, "What you got in there?" Dorothy unzips her bag and shows Lyra her crossbow and knives, deciding at the last minute to tuck some of the knives into the secret slot sewn into the lining of her jacket. Lyra takes notice of this and shakes her head, mumbling something like, "Shady knife seller," under her breath, and Dorothy can't help her smile. It's the exact reason she decided to have these in her pocket sewn in the first place. Plus, it adds something to her intimidation game when she pulls a knife from inside her jacket. "You ready?" Dorothy asks. "As I'll ever be," Lyra says. "I think we should head towards the lake. It's where the guy saw the beast last, and at the very least, it'll be a good starting point to attempt tracking him." Dorothy agrees, and they begin the several-mile hike to the lake. When they finally arrive, the sun has officially set, though they can't really tell, considering how thick and dark the cloud coverage has been over the past few days. They hear the distant shriek of a creature who has found some poor animal to chase after, and Dorothy wonders what kind of creature it is. "Can you tell what a creature is by the sound it makes?" she asks Lyra, as they search for any clues to the beast's whereabouts. Lyra shrugs. "Kind of. Like, the thing that just shrieked, I'm pretty sure is a shadow claw, but I haven't been fighting them long enough to know for sure." "Interesting," Dorothy says. She finds a smashed can of shitty beer lying in the sand, and she grumbles as she stoops down to pick it up. "Damn tourists, leaving their garbage everywhere." Lyra snorts. "It's depressing, really, that people do shit like that. Like, there are literally garbage cans every few yards along the beach. Just throw your shit in there, or put it in your own things until you get home." "Seriously," Dorothy says. She finds another can and scoops it up, too, finding the nearest trash can and heading to it, dropping both aluminum cans in. She's just about to turn back to her search with Lyra when she hears it. A low, rumbling growl coming from the line of trees. Lyra?" she calls. Lyra is by her side immediately, bat in hand, ready to throw down with whatever spooked Dorothy. She looks around, trying to assess the threat when she hears it too. Her eyes latch onto the area the sound is coming from, and she says, "Dorothy, I want you to get to the other side of the beach, and I want you to climb as high up into the trees as possible. Take aim with your crossbow, and shoot if things get messy." Dorothy doesn't hesitate. She springs into action, sprinting across the shoreline of the lake and disappearing into the trees on the other side. Lyra isn't sure whether she's in position yet, but she can't wait. She calls out, "I know you're there, Beastie. Why don't you come out so you and I can have a nice little chat?" The thing that slinks from the shadows is certainly beast-like. Though humanoid, the figure can only be described as anything but. He's exactly as horrifying as both Colin and Rufin said he is, and Lyra suppresses a shudder as his teeth make a horrible clicking sound. He gets close, only a couple yards away, when he stops and pulls the hood of his cloak down. "Lyra Myers," he says, his voice low and sounding as if he swallowed a mouthful of gravel. It gives Lyra's throat sympathy pains.
"It is a pleasure to finally meet you, the hero foretold by the seer, the woman who is supposed to end it all. Tell me, how does it feel to carry such a weight on your shoulders?" "I have found in my millennia of living, I much prefer following someone than leading anyone. It is much easier to roll over and show your soft belly to someone stronger than you."
He chuckles, as if at his own private joke.
"How does dear Rufus fare?"
"What did you do to him?" The beast smiles, his rows of sharp, jagged teeth glinting, even in the utter darkness surrounding them.
"Does the bumbling oaf still sleep, then? Pity. I was hoping I would get another chance to gut him."
Lyra doesn't show her hand, not yet. "What did you do to him?" she repeats. The creature snarls.
"I heard you the first time, girl. I do not answer to the likes of you."
He sniffs, as if Lyra has offended him somehow.
"Still, my mistress wants you to know, so you shall have the knowledge I possess. Consider it a gift, a sign of good faith from she whom I serve. I did nothing to Rufus, but remind his body of what it already should have known. It forgot during the many years he spent away from this wretched place."
He chuckles again.
"But it remembers now."
Lyra wants to attack him now, wants to smash his head in with the bat in her hands. Instead, she swings it idly back and forth beside her, making a show of being completely unaffected by the beast's words. "What exactly did you remind him of?" The beast smiles widely. Too widely.
"The lesson which my mistress's brother taught him 24 years ago. Stay out of the Fairy King's business, lest you face his wrath."
Lyra's heart quickens at the words Fairy King. She's heard of fairies before, of course, but only in the terms of fictional beings. Tiny creatures with wings and magical dust, or whatever the storybook said. But now, to have this beast reveal this much of his knowledge to her, to learn that the creatures that have been plaguing Mountain Hill for centuries are none other than fucking fairies? "You don't intend on letting me walk away with my life, do you?" she asks. Somehow, her voice remains steady, calm, despite the absolute terror roaring through her veins. The beast cocks its head at her.
"Why, of course not, Lyra Myers. My mistress wished for me to grant you this knowledge, but she never told me I had to let you live. And you are far more dangerous left filling your useless lungs with oxygen than you are dead."
His smile widens impossibly farther.
"You were dead the moment you walked onto this beach. You just didn't know it yet."
Lyra doesn't give herself the chance to think. She's moving before she can draw her next breath, leaping across the distance between them with her softball bat raised, calling upon all of her strength as she comes down swinging. She manages to catch the beast in the shoulder, despite his impossibly fast dodge attempt, and feels a short-lived moment of satisfaction as the thing howls in pain. Short-lived only because he spins, raking his claws down her leg and digging deepest into her calf. She lands awkwardly on that leg, and can't contain her scream of pain as she realizes the damn beast must have dug deep enough to reach bone. She rolls, losing her backpack somehow in her tumble, and lands on her back. She pushes herself up, spinning just in time to roll out of the way of yet another attack. This time, the beast catches her in the shoulder and stays there, holding her in place as she screams and screams.
"You were meant to do so many great and terrible things, Lyra Myers," the beast growls, sounding less and less human with every word.
you would have been our king's undoing, if only you had not come to face me. Too bad it is indeed.
There's a sudden sound of impact, and the beast is tearing his claws free of her shoulder. She collapses to the ground, pain radiating through her entire left arm and her right leg, fire racing across her bones. Her vision begins to go dark at the edges, and she briefly, hysterically wonders if she's going to die, but she doesn't have much time to worry before the entire world goes black. Dorothy isn't able to make it up a tree before a creature finds her. Not the beast, thank God, but something else just as awful. She's certain it isn't a merc, though it certainly looks similar enough. The only difference is that it isn't dripping water and doesn't seem entirely aware as it attacks her. She can hear Lyra speaking to the beast behind her, can barely make out their exchange as she fights the creature. A graveling, she thinks, based on, well, everything about it, but their words are too quiet for her to hear. She just hopes whatever happens between them doesn't turn out too bloody as she fights the weird-ass zombie thing off with just her knives. She's glad she made that last-second decision to tuck some away in her jacket. Glad she doesn't have to try getting into her bag as the thing keeps coming at her. She just barely manages to stab her knife deep into its eye, directly into its brain, when she hears the scream. Her heart is racing as she spins to the scene behind her, sees Lyra on the ground, rolling away from the beast as he swats at her. She's sprinting when the beast traps Lyra in place with his claws. She reaches them just in time to hear the beast say,
"You would have been our king's undoing, if only you had not come to face me. Too bad it is, indeed."
Her knife is plunging into the beast's head before he can say or do anything else. He yanks his claws free of Lyra's shoulder, and she collapses to the ground, unconscious. Dorothy doesn't exactly know how she's going to face the beast on her own, but she meant what she said to Lyra earlier. She will do anything for her friends, and if she can somehow keep this beast from killing Lyra long enough for Lyra to regain consciousness and get the fuck out of here, then that's what she's going to do. It's been a long time since Dorothy has had a cause she's willing to die for, and she couldn't be prouder that it's this. But the beast doesn't attack her. Instead, he falls to the ground, his entire body convulsing as he tries and fails to get a grip on the knife protruding from his skull. "Oh, fuck," Dorothy says, stomach turning as she watches him struggle. She tears her eyes away only after she's absolutely certain he isn't faking it, that he isn't going to suddenly spring up and attack her while she tries to help Lyra. Somehow, she accidentally found a temporary way to incapacitate him, and she certainly isn't one to look too closely at happy accidents. With the newfound strength she didn't have before moving to Mountain Hill, she scoops Lyra up and tosses her over her shoulder. Her backpack is on her back, but she sees Lyra as a handful of feet away from where she fell, and decides to scoop it up. It's heavier than she expects when it settles into the crook of her elbow, but not so heavy that she can't carry it. With one last look at the beast, still twitching on the ground where she left him, Dorothy spins on her heel and begins running back towards Mountain Hill. The woman sits, staring in disbelief at the scene unfolding before her. Though she never explicitly gave the order to her beast to kill the leader, she couldn't help the pride she felt when he decided to take matters into his own hands and kill her before she could really become a nuisance. But that other woman, Dorothy, she was an unknown. The woman never saw her through her beast's eyes, never knew she was hiding among the trees while her beast and Lyra spoke. She should have known better, of course. This pack of mongrels always has some trick or another up their sleeves. It's the only way they managed to escape her seekers, the merc, as they called them. She seethes as the vision suddenly goes hazy, knowing without a doubt in her mind that Dorothy somehow got the upper hand on her beast and managed to incapacitate him before he could finish what he set out to do. The trip from the island in the center of the lake is a short one. She has no need for vehicles, no need for the primitive boats the humans use to travel across the water. Her natural affinity to it allows her to command it. If she wills that she can travel from one great distance across a body of water to another, then the water shall do exactly as she asks it. Then, it is a short walk along the sandy beach to find her beast, and when she lays eyes on him, she cannot help the horrible scream as it tears herself from her throat. Thunder rumbles in her wake, and lightning flashes soon after, striking the sand around her as she walks towards her beast. She makes short work of pulling the knife from the back of his head, and using a small amount of her magic to mend his skin and bone and tissue. His convulsing eases until he merely trembles at her feet. "Hush," she says, as he begins sputtering apologies. "No need, sweetling. We will find them, and we will make them pay. Do you understand?" The beast nods.
"As you will it, mistress."
She smiles, knowing she looks as menacing as she feels as she says, "None but the boy Colin shall survive our wrath, my dear. But even he shall suffer greatly." She soothingly pets his head, humming quietly to herself before she says, "You have my word."